Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Landers, founding publisher of the JSOM. I'd like to thank you for joining the JSOM's 20th anniversary interview series. We are excited to bring together a host of experts, all leaders in the soft medical community. In these interviews, we will be discussing the ever-evolving methods of treating battlefield trauma and injury, and how those methods have changed over the 20 years since the JSOM's inception. I hope you'll find these talks as informative as we do.
And welcome back. We've got the privilege today of chatting with a very special guest. It's Lieutenant Colonel L'Esperance, who's a trauma surgeon at BAMC and has some previous SOF experience. Sir, you care to give our listeners a little bit of background about your involvement with SOF and military medicine as it stands?
Yeah. Thanks, Alex. My name's Lieutenant Colonel Rich L'Esperance. Currently, I am a trauma and critical care surgeon at Brooke Army Medical Center here in San Antonio, Texas. Prior to going to medical school, however, I had the distinct privilege of being a Special Forces medical sergeant. I spent about 10 years in group and training group. I spent about 4 years in 1st of the 10th SF in Germany. Then I spent a couple years in SWCC as an instructor down at the scuba school in Key West. And then several years in 20th Group National Guard in Ocala, Florida, while I was doing my pre-med. During my time in 10th Group, I had the privilege to do several deployments to northern Iraq, Bosnia, and a few other places. This was prior to the initiation of the Global War on Terror, of course, in 2001.
And since you decided to pivot from enlisted to officer through med school, you did med school, general surgery residency, and then your trauma critical care fellowship. So certainly no slouch, staying busy. And I also did a quick search on the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery, and it looks like you have been an author on 27 articles. Is that right?
I think there's fewer than that that I'm actually the author on. There is another Richard L'Esperance out there who I think is a radiologist or something who will show up through some of those. But I've authored or co-authored probably 10 or 15 articles in the field of trauma and resuscitation.
Holy smokes. Yeah, in the Google Scholar search I did also found a French Rich L'Esperance, which you could also take credit for.
I think that may be the radiologist. I'm not smart enough to take credit for that stuff. That's too much physics for me.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, really excited to chat with you today about the topic of tranexamic acid and its role within soft medicine and how it's changed in the last 20 years that the JSOM has been in publication. So to start off, would you be able to give our listeners a little bit of a background about where the topic of TXA in trauma came from? Was this a civilian or a military practice?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It evolved primarily from the civilian world. Tranexamic acid is actually an old drug. It's one that's been around for a while. I think it was first approved in the 80s. And it was used in the elective surgery setting. Just to recap for some of your viewers who use it but may have forgotten all the nuts and bolts of it, it's called a fibrinolytic inhibitor. So it stops the body's normal process of breaking down fibrin. That's part of the normal cascade, the normal balance that always happens in your body between clotting and breaking down the clot. And TXA tries to tip the balance towards clotting or decreasing the breakdown of clots. So way back in the 80s, surgeons thought that this might be helpful to decrease blood loss for surgery. And it has been shown in the elective setting in some orthopedic surgery, gynecology, cardiac surgery, to decrease the amount of blood transfusions that surgeons have to give their patients. So from that elective surgical use, some smart person in England back in the early 2000s thought it might have an applicability in the field of trauma to decrease bleeding as well. And there was kind of a famous study that was published in 2009, 2010, I think, called CRASH II, which basically wound up giving this medicine to thousands and thousands of trauma patients in 39 different countries all over the world and tried to look for a benefit for that. And that study was kind of interesting because it did show that giving this drug, randomizing this drug to be given or not given to trauma patients, did show a benefit of mortality. It was kind of a surprising finding because it seemed to not stop people from bleeding to death, but there was a clear signal in this larger study that tranexamic acid could save lives if given early for trauma patients. And because of that study, I think, is where the interest came from in the military of looking at this from the military perspective.
Yeah, that's fair. Although I know there's a number of criticisms of the CRASH II study out there. My biggest one, I think, that a lot of folks forget is the actual absolute reduction in mortality was only 1.5%, which is a pretty small number, but certainly every little bit to keep our soldiers alive matters.
Absolutely. There are entire podcasts just about the criticisms about the CRASH II study. Trust me on this. And people can argue about it till they're blue in the face. Interestingly enough, you're right about the 1.5% absolute mortality benefit. But they did what's called a pre-specified subgroup analysis, which is they said, before we even do the study, we're also going to analyze our data amongst those people that were given tranexamic acid within 1 hour of their injury. And when you look at just that group, and this is important for us in the special operations community, when they looked at their patients that got that medicine within 1 hour of wounding, that 1.5% went to 2.4%.
So a number needed to treat of 1 in 25?
About 42 was the number needed to treat when you looked at the group within 1 hour. Since then, there have been some other studies not looking specifically at bleeding to death, but other studies have suggested that it's not just a cutoff time of an hour, but as soon as you can give the tranexamic acid, there's going to be more benefit. So if the CRASH II study was able to look at tranexamic acid given within 15 minutes, theoretically, they might have even found a higher benefit, and that's of importance to us in the special operations community.
Yeah, so the closer to the point of injury that we can get this medication, potentially the improvement in outcome.
Exactly. We suspect that. We haven't been able to prove it yet, though.
Yeah, and I know the 2012 MATTERS trial, which was specifically a retrospective analysis of military members in Iraq. Is that right?
It was actually in Afghanistan, Alex, but you're exactly right. And interestingly enough, the MATTERS study was done at Camp Bashtin in Afghanistan, which is a hospital that was run by the UK. And the CRASH II study was headquartered out of the UK as well. So I can't help but wonder if that's where they decided to study it. If some of the study investigators involved in CRASH II found themselves deployed to Camp Bashtin and said, hey, it might work here. The MATTERS study was a retrospective study, and that's important to realize because retrospective studies are subject to a lot of different biases than this prospective study, randomized study like CRASH II was. So they didn't randomize people in the MATTERS study. They basically gave the sick people tranexamic acid. And they found a significant benefit of mortality. It was those that they gave tranexamic acid to, and these were, by and large, these were patients that look more like you and I are concerned about treating on the battlefield. These are primarily penetrating trauma, young patients who are bleeding to death. And when they gave those patients tranexamic acid, the mortality of the group that got the medicine was 17%. The ones who didn't get the medicine, the mortality was 24%. When you looked at the group that underwent massive transfusion, and these are the patients that we're really concerned about finding a magic bullet for, the patients who got greater than 10 units of blood in their first 24 hours after wounding, that benefit went from 14% to 28%. So half, almost 50% relative reduction in mortality, where you mentioned earlier a great statistic, which is the number needed to treat. which is how many people do I have to give this medicine to save a life? And amongst massive transfusion patients, it was 7. So literally, by pushing tranexamic acid out into the hands of pre-hospital providers and special operations environment, we are saving lives out there.
Yeah, that's pretty phenomenal. And I know you and I talked ahead of the recording a little bit about how much that point of injury dosing has changed in the last 20 years. So what's your current understanding of what the soft operator is doing as far as dosing? Where did we start with dosing, and what are we doing now for dosing at point of injury?
Well, what we started with dosing is actually the same dosing protocol that they studied in the CRASH II study, which is 1 gram of tranexamic acid given as an infusion over 10 minutes, and then followed up by a 2 gram of tranexamic acid that's given over the subsequent 8 hours. So a total of 2 grams, 1 gram up front fairly quickly over 10 minutes, and the second one is a slower infusion. And the current guidelines for tactical combat casualty care and the joint trauma system clinical practice guidelines both include that dosing regimen. But you've brought to my attention that there's some people in the pre-hospital arena right now that are experimenting with a much more rapid dosing, packing an IO with it or using it as an IO flush solution. And I can't say I'm familiar with any literature that supports that. I would be very interested in seeing the results published of that once we have enough patients that have undergone that, because that type of rapid application of tranexamic acid could be a two-edged sword. One other thing to think about with tranexamic acid, Alex, is that the CRASH II study, I told you that they found the greatest benefit was when it was given within 1 hour, but interestingly enough, when tranexamic acid was given over 3 hours after injury, there was a slightly higher mortality. And the clotting cascade is an inherently complicated thing to understand. Nobody really knows why there's an increased mortality when it's given that far after injury, but that's reflected in the current clinical practice guidelines, to where if you reach a patient greater than 3 hours, that's a situation in which you should not use tranexamic acid.
Yeah, fair enough. And speaking of dosing, if I remember correctly, the CRASH III trial that recently came out was looking at 2 grams of administration. Has the results of the CRASH III trial affected your practice as a trauma surgeon at all?
Well, CRASH III is an interesting study. CRASH III, even though it's the one that comes right after CRASH II, actually didn't look at the same thing. And that makes sense because CRASH I didn't look at the same thing that either one of them did. I think it's just a really cool sounding acronym, so people love it.
Yeah.
But CRASH III was actually looking at the effects of tranexamic acid, not on people bleeding to death, but on mortality after severe closed head injury. So CRASH III looked at 12,000 patients that had a moderate or severe brain injury, or that had any intracranial hemorrhage at all, so any type of brain bleed, regardless of how severe it was. And when they looked at everybody, there was no benefit when you gave it to everybody. But when they did, again, this subgroup analysis of where they broke down their results, when they saw the people that had only a mild or a moderate traumatic brain injury, so if their initial Glasgow coma scale was greater than 8, there was a small advantage in survival in the group that got TXA. It wasn't great. It was, I think, about 1.5% improvement. It was a number needed to treat of 60. But I mean, if you're that one person out of 60 and your life is saved by the tranexamic acid, you could argue that was a good outcome. And more importantly than the benefit, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is the potential harm, right? Anytime we talk about an intervention in the field of trauma or medicine, we want to weigh the cost of the intervention versus the benefits. And by cost, I don't mean money.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that in just a second with you, but, you know, I wanted to try and get our soft medics a little bit of education as well about kind of one of the big subgroup analysis differences that I saw between CRASH II and CRASH III, and you mentioned it as well, which is in CRASH II, it was a pre-specified subgroup analysis, whereas it's my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that CRASH III, that was not a pre-specified subgroup analysis. It was actually a post hoc. And, you know, my spidey sense usually tends to start tingling when I see that, because it tells me often that the investigators didn't find anything with the results and are then going back to try and find a meaningful result. What's your intake on that?
That's a great point. Anytime you see a post hoc subgroup analysis, that's exactly what you should think. That does not mean that the results are not valid. That just tells us what kind of a grain of salt we need to take the results with. So a pre-specified subgroup analysis means you've told everybody ahead of time this is what you're going to be looking at. And sometimes it's kind of like guilty of wishful thinking, because all of us who study these things, we study these topics because we think they're going to be a benefit. And at some level, we hope there's a benefit. But by using pre-specified subgroups, we're keeping ourselves honest, because it's really easy to subconsciously think, well, I know there's got to be some benefit here. Let me look at this subgroup. Let me look at this subgroup. Let me look at this subgroup after the fact. And then if you find a result in one of those subgroups, you don't know whether that was just because of sheer luck or whether you're looking for something that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot of the pessimists say that that's how much of the new pharmacology gets its literature saying it proves a benefit, is they end up making just a kajillion secondary outcomes, which aren't even successfully powered, but there's a signal in the noise.
Absolutely.
And all their publications can say, oh, this probably helps.
And without drilling down into statistics too much, you know, we use a p-value of less than 0.05 to determine whether or not something is statistically significant. But if you roll the dice enough times, you can get a lucky value that happens to be significant, even if in real life it isn't.
Yeah, that's fair. And actually, Josh is putting together a really good series on how to understand the literature. And he and I are going to talk a bit about p-values versus effect size, which is one of my...
Excellent.
Let's pivot a bit, because you brought up a great point, and I would love to pick your brain, both as a trauma surgeon as well as a former soft medic who has provided a lot of trauma care. What are some of the lessons learned about administering tranexamic acid, and what are some of the harms, complications, and second-order effects to think about when considering giving this medicine to one of your patients?
That's a great question, Alex. Anytime we give a medicine where it's going to help our patient stop bleeding, we're promoting coagulation, which, I mean, if somebody's exsanguinating, right, that's what we want. But there's lots of other things inside the body where if we stimulate too much coagulation can cause an untoward effect. So one of the things we've been watching for in all of these studies of tranexamic acid is any signs that we're causing harm by giving it. And the specific things we're looking out for are things like myocardial infarction, stroke, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, things like that that could be caused by giving a drug that's promoting the body's ability of coagulating. Because if we give this drug out to people and we only look at the mortality, say, or if we only look at the decrease in blood transfusion, for example, but we wind up finding out that we're giving a whole bunch of people strokes or heart attacks because their coronary arteries are thrombosing off, we may not be doing them a favor. To some extent, when we talk about cost versus benefit, when we're talking about cost, we mean the risk to the patient. But we are also talking about monetary cost too, because all of us have fixed budgets. All of us have to spend money on things. We can buy lots of bullets for training so our warfighters get better at putting rounds on target, or we can spend a lot of money on a few expensive medications that may or may not work. So if the medication doesn't work, or it has only a very slight benefit, but it's super expensive, it's not really worth it for us to carry. Luckily, tranexamic acid has been around long enough. It's a fairly inexpensive drug monetary-wise.
Yeah, that's fair. And I know in a lot of the morning PI meetings, I've heard you and others note that you have experienced an increase in thrombotic events in some of your injured military members, especially an increase in PEs. And do you guys have any data to show whether that's a causal relationship or if there's any definitive relationship with the therapy?
We don't at this point. It's something that we're more seeing in seriously injured patients. And it's important to note that, you know, there are people out there looking for this increase in thrombotic complications. But the bigger studies that promoted TXA use, like the CRASH II and the MATTERS study that we're talking about, didn't find any increase in thrombotic complications. CRASH II, as you mentioned, there's some criticisms to it, mainly the follow-up where you're going to find complications like that. But the MATTERS study was done in primarily young, healthy combat trauma patients. And about 60% of the patients in the MATTERS study were actually coalition patients. The majority of the others were Afghan nationals. So those patients all had very good follow-up. And when they looked at the rate of thrombotic complications between the two, there was really no significant increase between the two.
Gotcha. And I know I'm going to get a whole bunch of hate mail from some really smart medics who are going to criticize me because we know TXA is an anti-fibrinolytic. So what they're all going to say is that it doesn't actually promote thrombotic events as much as prevent the fibrinolysis. And how do you explain that to folks?
Yeah, the way I can explain it is that the smartest people I know in medical school stared at the clotting cascade and their brains popped off. The easiest way to describe it is that everywhere in the body, 100% of the time, there are clots being formed and there are clots being broken down. So the normal state of homeostasis in the coagulation cascade involves constant activation of the clotting cascade and downregulation of the clotting cascade. And in addition to that, that just initiates the clot. Anywhere there's a thrombus formed, as you probably remember from, you know, us taking care of pulmonary embolism patients in the ICU, you know, once a clot's formed, it propagates. Clot grows on top of clot. So if there's not an appropriate amount of fibrinolysis going on, then the clot's going to go wild, consume all the clotting factors. They're going to thrombose off one thing while they bleed out their eyeballs from everything else because they've used up all the fibrinogen in their system. So it's a delicate balance that goes on. The theory why tranexamic acid can help with hemostasis and can help in these massive transfusion patients is that we know from studies involving thromboelastography that there is a subset of patients that has what's called a fibrinolysis or excessive fibrinolysis or an antifibrinolytic shutdown. Like I said, ordinarily there's a balance going on, but when somebody suffers an extreme physiologic insult, i.e. draining most of their circulating volume onto the ground of Afghanistan, that normal balance can be tipped far off to one side or another. And if they have excessive fibrinolysis, the theory is that those are the patients that will benefit from the tranexamic acid and the inhibition of that inappropriate fibrinolysis. I will tell you that's just a working theory. There are people out there now that are studying using thromboelastography to try and identify the trauma patients that are having inappropriate fibrinolysis and only give those patients tranexamic acid to see if there's a benefit from it. But all this has a lot of smart people scratching their heads trying to figure out how the actual benefit occurs. Furthermore, there may be another benefit to tranexamic acid that does not involve hemostasis at all. We talked about the CRASH III study. Well, none of those people were bleeding to death. They all just had head injuries. And even though the CRASH II found a significant benefit to mortality in patients they gave tranexamic acid to, most of those patients weren't bleeding to death. Only half of them even got a single unit of blood. And of those patients that got any blood transfusion, there was no difference in the amount of blood transfusion they got between the group that got tranexamic acid and the group that didn't. So even though the fibrinolytic shutdown is a complicated concept to wrap your head around, what tranexamic acid is doing is probably even deeper than that on some level.
Oh, wow. So you're saying we don't know everything then is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. And you know what, Alex? Sometimes you just have to fall back on Murphy's Laws of Combat. If it's stupid but it works, it isn't stupid.
Yeah.
So this is a variety of that.
Yeah.
If it works but we don't fully understand how it works, it still works. Hey, Alex, after almost 60 years of Tylenol existing in the United States, you know, we still don't know how Tylenol works.
Touche. That's fair. As long as we're trying to make sure to select the right patients so that the benefits are greater than the harms.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fair. And speaking of folks figuring out where to administer TXA and to whom, how about who do you think is the current audience for TXA for trauma patients? You happen to span the scope of pre-hospital care, civilian trauma care, and military trauma care. And are you seeing TXA just with the PJs, soft medics, conventional forces, TEMS? Where do you see it these days?
I'm seeing pretty much widespread acceptance of TXA use, both in the military and in the civilian communities. And I say widespread, but I'm not seeing universal. As you alluded to, there's a lot of people who criticize the CRASH II study, and a lot of people, especially in the civilian arena, that don't feel that the MATTER study is applicable to their patient population. There are several very well-respected, big-name trauma centers out there that do not give tranexamic acid to their massive transfusion patients because they think the data is lacking and they suspect that there is an increase in thrombotic complications that just haven't been fully proven. That being said, I would say where I practice both in the military and in the civilian world, more people are believers in tranexamic acid than aren't. And we're seeing large frequencies of pre-hospital providers that are administering tranexamic acid with a very low threshold.
And if I remember correctly, I think for STRAC, the administration criteria for the pre-hospital providers is some physiologic derangements of blood pressure and heart rate. And then do I remember that for BAMSI, you guys are using that more based on gestalt of those who are going to require a massive transfusion protocol?
Well, Alex, here at BAMSI, we're administering tranexamic acid to patients that we anticipate have a high likelihood of needing a massive transfusion. There are some prospective scores out there that we can use to try to predict who's going to get a massive transfusion. Unfortunately, those scores, they work great in identifying some patients, but there's still a lot of clinical gestalt, as in this patient looks sick. Interestingly enough, most of those patients that we get into the trauma bay at BAMSI have already been given tranexamic acid out in the field by pre-hospital personnel. I don't know routinely that our ground EMS does it, but a very large percentage of patients that we get via rotary wing do receive tranexamic acid. You mentioned the acronym STRAC earlier. Just for our listeners who might not be familiar with it, STRAC is the name for the Southwest Texas Regional Advisory Committee, which is the trauma network that oversees and coordinates all trauma care in pretty much all of South Texas. So it's 22 counties, 10 million citizens. Don't quote me on the population, but a lot of people. And there's a lot of big distances involved. So we do wind up getting a significant portion of our trauma patients that can come from 2, 3, 4, sometimes even 5 hours away. Many times these patients have received tranexamic acid at the scene, at the referring hospital, or en route to us.
And I was actually just thinking about this. If you guys are using MTPs as your decision point, I'm going to be curious going forward with the use of whole blood, how that changes, because my limited experience there was that whole blood meant folks needed less blood and potentially not triggering an MTP. And I know also the definition of MTP is switching from the first 24 hours to the first few hours. So it'll be interesting to see how all that pans out.
Yeah, absolutely. We're caught in an interesting place in trauma care with the rapid adoption of whole blood resuscitation. If we say 10 units of blood, you know, we meant that's the FFP plus the RBCs and then throw in a couple of platelets there. But obviously, 10 units of whole blood means something quite different than 4, 4, and 2.
Yeah, fair enough. And then we always like to wrap up this look back across the ages or the past couple of decades by asking the question of how have we quantified the benefit of TXA within the military trauma population?
So, Alex, that's an excellent question. I don't know if we've looked at the joint trauma system outcomes to see specifically about tranexamic acid. That would be a great question to drill down into. What I can tell you is that tranexamic acid is just one of 50 or 60 significant improvements we've made over the last 2 to 3 decades of trauma care, really since the global war on terror started. The way I was taught as a young medic in 1992 is completely different from the way soft medics are practicing now. And just the improvement in the quality and the training of the young medics here that have that the special operations community and the conventional medic community, for that matter, have made in the last 20 years has truly been inspiring for an old fart like me who's looking back and remembering how it was back in the days when I was a medic and we all had muskets and rode horses into battle.
That's fair. And, you know, that actually reminds me that Josh and I, when we do our How to Understand Research, need to cover the Hawthorne effect, because it may not be necessarily that TXA is the be-all, end-all of trauma care. It's just that we're doing a great job with trauma care now, and TXA is a part of that.
Definitely with pre-hospital, we have come head and shoulders above where we were. When I was first learning trauma care as an 18 Delta student, I was taught every trauma patient gets bolused with 2 liters of crystalloid, no question asked. If I did that nowadays, somebody would knock my head off. That's just one example of how far we've improved our training of the pre-hospital providers.
Pretty phenomenal. Since you happen to be one of those few folks who's really seen the gamut of military medical care, do you happen to have any wisdom or insight that you'd be willing to share with some of our soft medics out there about things you know now as a trauma surgeon and former soft medic in terms of learning or providing trauma care kind of from a global learning perspective?
Just to seek out knowledge everywhere you can. Never be afraid to admit that you don't know something, and never be afraid to reach out and grab somebody and say, hey, can you teach me this? I can remember my clinical rotations as an 18 Delta student and sometimes being afraid of thinking I was going to be bothering the surgeons or the emergency medicine doctors or even the more experienced medics I was working with or the paramedics. I remember specifically thinking, well, I'm supposed to know this, so if I ask this question, it's going to reveal the fact that I don't know this. But the times I was able to get outside of that box and ask questions and show people that I wanted to learn, I can still to this day remember specific things or specific skills that I acquired as a young medic because somebody said, oh, hey, this guy's interested. Yeah, sure, I'm more than happy to teach. As you well know, surgeons and physicians in these academic centers, if anything, we love to teach so much. So the problem will be getting us to shut up, not getting us to teach all of the people around us who are all part of this healthcare delivery continuum.
Yeah, absolutely. And it certainly seems like BAMC has really embraced the paradigm of being the medical readiness platform for getting our folks ready to go take care of injured warfighters.
Absolutely. That is the only reason BAMC exists, Alex. There is no other reason for the Army to run a level one trauma center who primarily takes care of civilians that are ordinarily not eligible for TRICARE. And that's to help train everybody, not just me, not just you, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the paramedics, the 68 Whiskies, the 18 Deltas who rotate with us, everybody who's all part of that team, to just get them exposed to as many banged up trauma patients as possible so that we can turn around and when we deploy, we can take those lessons with us.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time and insight today. As I'm sure most of the folks will realize through this, you've just got a wealth of experience and training that's just so appreciated for those of us that probably don't know as much as you will have forgotten between when you wake up and have coffee. So thanks again for sharing your time and insight, Dr. L'Esperance.
Alex, I'm still learning every day in this job myself, and it's more than my pleasure to help share what little I know. And as you've probably seen, I refer to myself as a student of trauma care, and I have been for 27 years now, and I will continue. There's not a day I don't go to work where I don't learn something new.
Fair enough. Good words to live by. Well, thanks so much for your time, sir.
All right. Take care, Alex. My pleasure.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers and welcome your feedback and suggestions.